From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we start with the latest on the impeachment investigation, where we've learned that White House officials were worried President Trump was breaking the law when he ordered a hold on military aid to Ukraine. That's according to new transcripts released yesterday by impeachment investigators. One witness, a career Office of Management and Budget official, said he was not told why there was a hold when it was first placed on the aid over the summer by the president. All of this comes as impeachment proceedings head to the Judiciary Committee and a possible trial in the Senate. For more, we're joined by NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. And Claudia, remind us who these two witnesses are. They testified a while ago, but we're just getting their transcripts now.
Right. So the first witness, Mark Sandy, is a career official, as you mentioned, at the Office of Management and Budget. And he is the only OMB official to testify in this inquiry so far. The House Intelligence Committee sent notifications for other OMB officials to come before the panel, like Sandy's superiors, but they all refused. The other official is Philip Reker, a State Department official who was able to corroborate evidence from other witnesses.
Okay. And what are the major takeaways from these two depositions?
So both emphasize the confusion and the uncertainty surrounding the hold on this aid for several weeks. In Mark Sandy's case, he was able to detail the mechanics and the timing behind the delay and his efforts to alert a top OMB official that they could break the law if this aid wasn't released by the end of the fiscal year in September. In Reker's case, he highlighted the roles that a lot of these key figures in this inquiry played in this saga, from the dismissed ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, and acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney. And he corroborated a lot of the testimony that we have heard so far in the inquiry. Mm.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Mark Sandy and the mechanics that he laid out. So according to the transcripts, he said he was told that the hold on aid came directly from the president, but it came with no explanation until weeks later. How does this detail fit into the timeline we've heard from the other witnesses, and why does it matter?
Yes, so President Trump's defenders have said that when Sandy, in terms of his testimony, they said this hold was placed because of concerns of corruption and that it was clear. However, Sandy testified that Trump began asking about questions about the aid going back to June. He learned about the hold on the aid through a July email from a top aide to White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. And the first official act to stop at least a large portion of this security assistance took place through a letter on July 25th, signed by an OMB official. So it doesn't quite track with what we've heard from the president's defender so far.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, it really kind of undermines what the president is saying, that the president held up aid because he had legitimate concerns about corruption. Sandy also said two officials at the White House Office of Management and Budget resigned in part over these concerns about the holdup. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, yeah, so Sandy testified he wasn't alone in these concerns on this hold. He said these two OMB officials resigned at least in part because of the confusion and concerns surrounding it. One official who left in September had expressed frustrations with requests to hold up this kind of assistance. He said the other individual worked in OMB's legal section, and they left at least in part because of this. And he said at least one of these individuals expressed concerns for not understanding the reason behind the hold.
Okay, what has the president and his defenders said about this latest piece of information?
So President Trump was quick to get on his Twitter account last night after the transcripts were released and retweeting claims that when Sandy was talking about the dismissal of these two officials, that really wasn't about the Ukraine assistance. It was more general and more broad concerns that they left on those grounds. So just trying to raise doubt in terms of Sandy's testimony, especially.
Okay. With the few minutes we have left with you, I want to talk about the bigger picture. The House Intelligence Committee is wrapping up its work, and the Judiciary is picking up the impeachment inquiry. That committee will ultimately be responsible for drafting articles of impeachment. Are we expecting to learn any more details about this freeze aid or the investigations the president wanted?
I think by how we've seen this inquiry proceed, that with every new witness, every new deposition, there seems to be a new development in this probe. And our understanding from House Democrats is they are not going to stop this inquiry from proceeding forward and moving to this stage with the Judiciary Committee. But I would expect we could see new developments. We could see new hearings connected to these developments. But there will be a parallel track with Judiciary. They will continue on their path. They have their first hearing on Wednesday, and that will feature next week. And it'll feature a panel of legal experts that will cover kind of the historical aspect of impeachment, how it applies to the Trump case. And this is part of their march towards possibly drawing up these articles of impeachment by possibly the end of this year.
Possibly the end of this year. Thanks for laying this out for us. That was NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, staying in the world of politics, for the first time ever, Latinos will be the largest minority group voting in next year's general election. That's about 32 million voters, according to the Pew Research Center. In Texas, Latinos make up nearly a third of the electorate and are an increasingly vital bloc in that state. Historically, Republican candidates have earned as much as half of the Latino vote in Texas, but times may be changing. New data shows that anti-immigrant rhetoric may be alienating the state's Latino Republicans. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovell reports.
Texas Hispanic voters are among the most conservative compared to the rest of the nation's voting Latinos. However, there are signs that some Texas Latinos who once voted Republican are reconsidering. Pete Garcia is one of them.
I've been Republican all my life. You know, I started voting back when Reagan was in office. I hope I helped him get elected back then.
Garcia is executive director of the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce and says his political views are separate from his role at the chamber.
I can't say that I was really heavily favoring Hillary Clinton at the time, but it was there were not many options.
For the first time in a presidential election, Garcia broke from his party and voted for Clinton in 2016. Why?
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best.
Those comments not only hurt the illegal immigrants, but I know a lot of people that are from not only Mexican, but from Hispanic origins felt the same way that I did.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Garcia blames Trump's rhetoric for racial violence, like what allegedly motivated the shooter who killed 22 people in El Paso. Garcia says he won't vote for Trump and predicts he's not alone among Latino Republicans. And there's some polling that says he may be right.
Things that repel the Latino community from the Republican Party tend to be issues involving immigration.
Brandon Rodinghouse is a political science professor with the University of Houston. His new research about Latino Republicans in Texas shows that hardline immigration talking points and policies hurt GOP approval among Latinos.
Republicans have counted on the support of about 30 to 35% of the Latino community in the past couple of decades, but those numbers are changing quickly.
A September Univision University of Houston poll shows that only 19% of registered Hispanics in Texas say they plan on voting for Trump. That could make Texas more competitive for Democrats.
Look, I always say Texas is purple. Just because we don't have a statewide elected Democrat doesn't mean we're not purple.
Representative Will Hurd of San Antonio is the state's only Republican congressman who represents a border district. He says Republicans have a branding problem with Latinos.
I think we need to be changing some of the rhetoric and also some of the things that we support to make sure that we're competitive with the largest growing groups of voters. And I always say that if the Republican Party doesn't start looking like Texas, there's not going to be a Republican Party in Texas.
But state GOP leaders counter that they are doing a lot to appeal to Latinos. Here's Texas GOP Chairman James Dickey.
We have been intentional in making sure that we have done great engagement efforts through our staff, which is a third bilingual, over half minority and or female.
Dickey says he's not worried that Democrats will take over. Republican Governor Greg Abbott was reelected with 42% of the Latino vote in 2018. But University of Houston's Brandon Ridinghouse says Republicans should be cautious with their immigration message because it's not just Trump that alienates otherwise Republican voting Latinos. It's also state and local officials.
Republicans in Texas are talking about border security issues in much more dramatic and sometimes offensive terms to Latinos. And that is definitely creating a wedge where they're less likely to support them than they were in the past.
In 2018, in the last big statewide election, a surge in Latinos voting for Democrats almost was enough for Democrat Beto O'Rourke to defeat incumbent U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. And with the Latino population growing in Texas, their vote could prove pivotal in the 2020 election. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Trovall.
And now, we want to listen to the music of the well-known 19th century French composer, Louise Farrenc. Okay, maybe you haven't heard of Louise Farrenc. This is her third symphony. And our culture writer, Fran Hoffner, believes that it should have cemented Farrenc's place in the classical canon, but not surprisingly for her time and ours, it didn't. So let's explore Louise Farrenc with Fran. Hi, Fran.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And at the beginning of your writing about Louise Farrenc, you make a confession. This is a blind spot for you.
Yeah, I think French classical music, as well as just sort of female composers, is a huge blind spot for me.
Yeah, well, you're going to make up for that. And for us, not knowing about Louise Farrenc, those of us who don't, tell us about her.
So she comes of age around the time of Beethoven. So when we think of French classical music, I think we think of Camille Saint-Saëns, we think of Debussy. All those guys come way later in the 19th century, and Louise Farrenc is born in 1804. So she's on the earlier side of things, and she has these big sort of Germanic and like Central European influences on her music. That's not quite as like delicate or playful as the stuff that comes later in the century.
Well, so very early, but not a time without, as you write, female composers. There were others.
Right. You have, you know, your Fanny Mendelssohns, you have Clara Schumann, but those composers, as much as I love them, have a last name that is also tied to another male composer. And Louise Farrenc stands very much on her own.
Mm-hmm. Her husband was a musician, and he did some music publishing, but he wasn't famous.
Right.
So he didn't pole vault her. So tell us a little more about her sound, because you write two things. First, as a woman, people kind of think, oh, a woman is going to write delicately, which is diminishing. And also that she was French, but you talk about the difference between the French and Germanic sounds you were mentioning.
Well, I think when we think about classical music sort of on the whole, there's a very, you know, militaristic, powerful German sound that starts with Beethoven and goes far into like Mahler. And with French music, we think of something a little more expressionistic, but that music comes more in the Romantic era. So because Farrenc is sort of right there in the classical era, she's drawing on these Germanic influences. Like, she was alive when Beethoven's Ninth came out, and it's hard to imagine hearing something like that as a young person and not wanting to have your music sound like that as well.
Well, let's listen to the beginning of the first movement of her Third Symphony. And as you write, it starts off with, I don't know, some of that delicateness maybe we were talking about. This is Adagio Allegro. But pretty soon, you know, as her music goes on, we hear some of those influences you're talking about. Okay, there she is.
Yeah.
What do you think was going on there? You say maybe she was teasing, you know, saying, I think you think I'm going to do this as she starts.
Yeah, I think she's feigning a little bit of nervousness right up at the top to maybe lure the listener into a sense of unease or almost distrust. And then she sort of swoops in with that fervor and is like, you're safe, you're fine. Like, I know where this is going.
Okay. And now we have a second movement, Adagio Cantabile. Let's listen. What are you hearing here, Fran Hoffner?
Well, as a former timpanist, I'm always listening for the timpani, and it's just there very quietly in the background of most of this piece as this really steady heartbeat. So in the Adagio movement, it's supposed to be, you know, slower and more expressive, but I think she wants that constant rhythm to it so it doesn't slip too much into, you know, nostalgia or sentimentality.
That timpani was that like distant thunder that they kind of heard there. Okay, famous first as a performer on the piano. Talk about the shift to symphonies, which is a huge undertaking.
Yeah, symphonies were not exactly the types of pieces that French composers were writing at this time. This was very much in the German tradition. And because she was a female composer, you know, a lot of her playing and composing was for parlor rooms. Like very much in the home, not necessarily her home, but the home of more wealthy patrons. And symphonies are a really public art. So it took a lot of time and effort to get to the point in her career where she was able to like premiere a symphony. I think she had a career a lot like working artists have careers now where they, you know, they teach and they have their sort of steady job. And then once every now and then they get to do something big and splashy on their own terms.
Well, I want to listen to the third movement. You say it's the most fun. Instruments storming in and out. Now, I feel like I'm hearing Beethoven here. Is this what you're saying when you think she was conscious of him?
Absolutely, yeah. I think his influence is all over this. But it does it does feel distinctly her own. Like, I don't think Beethoven is this playful a lot of the time.
So, Fran, we know the music of Louise Ferranc was praised by people like Robert Schumann. At the time, she had a prestigious position of professor of piano at the conservatory, the only woman of the 19th century to hold that. She was acknowledged.
Definitely, but I think just lost in the wayside of the canon, which is so much controlled by men.
Yeah.
You know, I think she felt like maybe like a phase, or because she was so heavily influenced by Beethoven, it just gets lumped into the Beethoven legacy versus the Ferranc legacy.
Huh. Well, let's continue to rectify that. Let's listen to the fourth movement of Louise Ferranc's Third Symphony. This one is another allegro. This huge finale where she goes for broke. Let's listen. Minute. She's not ending yet.
No, it's so full of false endings. She's really just like continuing to play tricks throughout this one.
Fake out. What else are you hearing here in the end?
She's kind of pulling out all the stops in a way that I will say also feels very Beethovenian, where it's like anything she maybe didn't have room for in the three movements preceding it, she's like, throw it in the finale. And it creates this very overwhelming sense of self, I guess. And as a listener, I find myself pulled in all sorts of different directions.
Well, I'm thinking, too, it may be something she can express in music that women at that time couldn't express in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially like as a pianist, to have the range of a full symphony, you know, like maybe there's only so much she can say with the piano, but like let her write for trumpet, let her write for timpani, let her write for cello and violin. She allows like all these voices within her to speak as well.
So maybe we're hearing kind of a rebel there.
Yeah.
That's culture opinionator Fran Hoffner, who writes about classical music for WQXR in New York and is also teaching at Rutgers. And admitting to a blind spot in her own awareness of musical and trying to make up with that, French classical music, and in particular the music of Louise Ferranc. But while we have you, what other female composers do you think we should give a listen to?
I'm a huge fan of Fanny Mendelssohn, who is the sister of Felix Mendelssohn. I love both the Mendelssohns equal amounts. But Fanny is also a pianist, like Louise. And I think that her piano sonata in G minor that I just adore.
Fran Hoffner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we haven't even gotten to Thanksgiving yet, but America's biggest shopping season is right around the corner. And Amazon workers, they're feeling intense pressure to deliver packages fast and on time. At the Staten Island warehouse in New York yesterday, about 100 warehouse workers gathered to protest high injury rates and a grueling quota system that requires them to pack 2,000 Amazon orders a day. That's 4 packages a minute. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, let's first talk about this Staten Island warehouse.
Yeah.
This is a facility that, according to Amazon's own data, has an injury rate 3 times higher than similar work, warehouse work. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, Amazon has more data on everything than kind of anyone else, so they even know this. An OSHA report on the warehouse stated that that fulfillment center, which is where orders get to be mailed out to you, has a incident rate that is higher than any other job that is monitored by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is part of the Department of Labor, and is 3 times higher than the warehouse work average. The issue here is that Vox has reported, and others have reported, that Amazon workers just have to keep up this 2,000 unit per day thing. That's 4 items per minute. And if they stop just for a few seconds outside of their designated breaks, it hurts their performance evaluations.
I mean, it's part of being human, though, to stop at moments to take a break, those types of things.
Not in a one day delivery environment, particularly as you get to Christmas, right? This is the thing: retailers, including Amazon, are competing to get things out faster and faster and faster. When you buy things on the internet, there are some things that offer to deliver within a few hours. All of this is putting remarkable pressure, and the industry that deals with packing these goods is not evolving to sort of say maybe 2 breaks a day is not sufficient for people who have to pack this much stuff.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. Amazon is making this huge investment in one-day shipping. And,
yeah.
I mean, how do these workers' complaints actually fit into that strategy? Do you think it might be this short-term pain as they transition to this, or is it a larger show of maybe workplace culture?
Yeah, they're worried that it's going to be a bigger problem, right? These workers are pushing for 3 30-minute breaks during a 10-hour shift, and then 2 15-minute breaks and a 30-minute break for lunch. So they're trying to figure out how to do this, but there are reports out there that this kind of work, the pain that comes from standing and packing boxes, could be a sign that people will develop certain disorders that they don't have, injuries to their joints, their ligaments, their muscles, their nerves, their tendons, repetitive strain injuries. So there's, and by the way, that's all psychologically distressing too. So people really need this work. They take it, they work really hard, and then they get sick. So this is where, you know, they're trying to unionize at this particular plant, but there are real concerns that this has to be addressed now. We want faster goods for less money. There is an entire class of people who are now being affected by this. And it's not just warehouse workers, it's drivers too.
Drivers as well. Yeah, drivers as well. I mean, it really begs the question in the 30 seconds that we have with you. I mean, do we need to rethink our demand for this same day or one day shipping? Or can we actually turn this ship around? Is that already sailed? And how will we get through this?
Or there's a third option that it's not all free, right? You want faster shipping and people have to work harder. We have to pay more. We have to have more shifts. We have to give people breaks. I think there's an answer to this, but we don't have it yet. And as we're gearing up, and every time you hit click, remember, we may be contributing to the problem.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you very much.
Excellent.
There's a new fear for women trying to escape abusive partners, digital domestic abuse. Abusers using smartphone apps connected to devices to stalk and monitor their victims, or worse. One abuser tracked a woman through car technology, controlling her windows, stopping and starting her car remotely. A survey from the National Network to End Domestic Violence found that 50% of victim service providers reported that offenders were using cell phone apps to stalk survivors. Another 41% reported that abusers use GPS tracking. Diana Fried is a researcher and PhD candidate specializing in digital security and privacy at Cornell Tech in New York City. So, Diana, how are you working with this?
So what we've done at Cornell Tech is, in collaboration with the mayor's office, we now run a tech clinic once a week in each of the five boroughs to see clients experiencing this problem. And we see about four clients a week, because that's the amount that we can handle in a day. But this is a constant problem that's getting increasingly more prevalent given the pervasiveness of digital technologies and, as you said, smart home devices.
What are they saying? What are the things they're seeing?
Well, we have a lot of intimate partner violence. And so what happens in these cases is that because of the intimate nature of the relationship, the abuser has access to information about the victim. And when the abuser and the victim separate ways, if the person leaves, people are still being tracked and they can't fully escape. So people come in with us and will say, he is tracking me. He knows where I am. The person might know things that the survivor didn't tell him, and there's just this constant concern that someone knows information and is continuing to know information, and no one understands really how it's happening.
Well, why can't you just take the apps out? Why can't they just say, you know what, I'm not going to have an app to turn on my lights? We're reading in the New York Times about a woman whose husband is an engineer. He controls the lights, the thermostat, the music. But why? Why can't you just delete the app?
Well, in the cases of the home apps, if they're installed in a way where the abuser is already is the leader of the account or the head of the account, it doesn't allow the survivor to have access of control. So that's already installed in their homes. What we're seeing a lot of is that much of the surveillance that we see doesn't actually always occur through a spyware app. What happens is that quite often the abuser has set up some of the accounts on the person's phone. Mm. They might have bought the device for the survivor, and they are accessing information quite often through a shared family plan, through a shared iCloud account, but the person isn't necessarily aware that they're still sharing that information. Right. So a lot of the tracking that we're seeing is not actually a sophisticated situation. It's just the fact that there was a very intimate relationship at one point in time that allowed the abuser to have logon information, access to accounts, access to the physical device.
But we're also hearing from professionals that this is a kind of a warfare that can escalate, and women are even endangered if the abuser finds out that they are trying to disassemble this technology, this is tough.
It's extremely difficult. And so the way that we try to approach this is we will identify, if we can, you know, the problem and figure out how this is happening. But then we do not advise to immediately remove an app or disable an account or log someone out if they're already logged into a device. What we try to do is have the person safety plan with a case manager, a lawyer, and make a safe decision. So we could explain to them at the time what the abuser will know if they make a change to their technology.
This gets so frightening. Some abusers are using parenting apps, apps that were meant for checking in on children, to track survivors.
Yes, there are. We call that area of apps dual-use apps. And so applications that have a legitimate use case but then are misused in cases of intimate partner violence. And this extends to things like Find My Friends, to Google Maps, to normal applications that might also be on the phone. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is when people come to see us, what we do is we have a protocol that we follow whereby we ask questions. We also developed a spyware scanning tool that we're able to scan phones and any type of tablets to see if both dual-use apps and spyware apps are on the devices. And then we manually go through the configurations on the phones to make sure that somebody didn't add their fingerprint or that they didn't add themselves as a user on Google Maps or Find Friends or a parenting app, like you're saying.
Well, it gets particularly frightening, though, my point, when it's an app to track children because it's a reminder from an abuser to another parent, you know, perhaps the mother, I know where your children are because I have that tracking possibility. Do tech companies have some legal obligation here to make sure that their technology isn't being used by abusers?
So it's being misused by abusers, and I think everybody's working together to figure this out. The problem is that they're misusing everyday technology, and the same things might happen with social media. So we have made companies aware of these types of ways, and people are working on it together, and it's becoming much more evident as this problem grows.
Well, we know the law is trying to keep up. There are some states have revenge porn laws. So if you get into somebody's devices and you can get pictures and tapes and things, you can't circulate them. But there's also a push now to get courts, when they do restraining orders, to include devices that people who have a restraining order against them aren't allowed to use shared home device accounts. But, you know, that's still an evolving legal world. It's unbelievable. What would you recommend, though, with what you know? What would you recommend to women the first thing to do if they think they are being stalked by an abuser through their technology?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to try to work with a professional, if possible, to figure out how they're accessing the information. So is it through maybe a shared email account, and perhaps to do a self-check on, did the person buy this device for you? Do they pay the bill and see where you are, what calls you're making? Have they at any time had access to your physical device, to a vehicle you might share? So really trying to think about what shared accounts the person has had and what type of way they might still be accessing it. And that's very difficult to do without really speaking to someone who might have a little more tech experience, but it's a starting point. And then if it's safe to do so, changing all the passwords, possibly changing an email, iCloud account. We have on our website questions that we ask when we are doing our intakes with survivors, and we make that all of our work publicly available.
Oh, that's great.
And this is an area, you know, that we're focusing on.
Well, that's terrific. We'll link people up to Cornell Tech again. Briefly, Diana, when you say people should contact a professional, how do you know? I mean, what are they called? You know,
it's an excellent question. And there's everything from going to the different types of phone stores, technology stores, but they're not always so sensitive to these cases of intimate partner violence, because this is first becoming more prevalent and more awareness. And so they don't always know the socio-technical complexities. But if there is someone who's providing services that does have someone who might be more aware of the technology aspect of it, we are one of the few groups right now doing this work. But we're trying to create collaborations and build up awareness so that more people can provide services. But it's difficult. But I think looking at the obvious things such as the passwords, connected accounts, and seeing how they can disconnect is a first step.
That's Diana Fried, a researcher and PhD candidate at Cornell Tech. Diana, thank you so much. As we said, we'll link people up at hereandnow.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, that woman whose husband was raising and lowering her thermostat remotely tore it out of the wall. Hopefully she got it replaced. If you are a victim of abuse or being stalked in any way, we will link you to the National Domestic Violence Hotline at hereandnow.org.
Journalists in Egypt are shaken after last weekend's raid of one of the last independent news outlets, Mada Masr. Security forces arrested editor Shadi Zalah, along with three other journalists. Officers also confiscated cell phones and laptops. The journalists have all been released, but this is the latest in a series of crackdowns on press freedom and civil society in Egypt. Joining me now to talk more about all of this is Justin Shalad, senior Middle East and North Africa researcher for the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's been following this story. Hello, Justin.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about what happened to these journalists over the weekend.
So I think what happened is that it started with Shadi's detention, and then the following day on Sunday, the Egyptian police came to Mada Masr's office, held the staff there for a period of time, including Lina Atallah, Rama Mdouh, and Mohamed Hamama, as well as two journalists from France 24 who were there to interview Lina about Shadi's arrest. And and then they also, I think, had detained at the offices an American and a British staffer for the website as well. Lina, Rana, and Mohamed were taken to the Do'i police station and then started to be driven somewhere else. But then, as far as we know, the police truck turned around, went back, and then they were released a few hours later.
Okay. I want to get to maybe some reasons why that happened, but we should mention you used to work with the editor-in-chief of Mada Masr when you both were at the Egypt Independent. And let's talk a little bit more about the publication. It's being called one of the last independent media outlets in Egypt. Can you tell us more about it and why perhaps it would be a target?
Sure, absolutely. Mada does the type of independent and really very dogged reporting that is increasingly hard to come by in Egypt. Don't get me wrong, there are many, many talented journalists in the country who are doing that kind of work, but they do very in-depth investigative reporting, and they do a lot of it on topics that the Egyptian government would certainly find embarrassing. Mm. I think that they're significant because they publish in both English and Arabic, and they're, I think, for both Egyptian and international audiences, they are one of the few remaining sources of news on the government and politics of Egypt, on the economy, and on other sensitive issues that most other local outlets can't really cover.
You mentioned those sensitive issues. Last week, Mada Masr published a major story about Mahmoud al-Sisi, President al-Sisi's son and a senior official in the Egyptian intelligence service. And many have been speculating that the raid this weekend was retribution for that article. Can you tell us what they reported and why it might have upset the government?
The reporting was that Mahmoud al-Sisi was being reassigned to military intelligence delegation to Moscow after previously having served as senior post for the General Intelligence Services in Egypt. According to Mada Masr's reporting, this reassignment happened after there have been increasing concerns within senior levels of government over Mahmoud al-Sisi's response to the protests that briefly broken out in September, and also in response to concerns that he was, ironically, not properly controlling the media and the media narrative in Egypt.
Oh.
What's the status of Mahdi Masrur right now? You mentioned that the journalists who were detained are now free, but do we have any sense of whether the raid has hindered their ability to keep reporting?
It's important to note that Mahdi Masrur has been operating under a fair amount of pressure from the authorities for a while now. Starting in 2017, the Egyptian authorities started blocking websites, including news websites en masse, which previously, even by their own standards, they had not gone that far in terms of repressing the free press. But the last that we learned of today is that state-run Al Haram newspaper quoted an official saying that, from the prosecution, I believe, saying that they were accusing Mahdi Masrur of being founded by, quote, members of the banned Muslim Brotherhood. So it's unclear what the status of the case is against them. Needless to say, it's not a situation where anyone is in the clear yet. And given the current press freedom environment in Egypt, I don't think that you can say the same for any independent journalist there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about what's next. And is there anything the U.S. or any other country could be doing about it?
I think that the most important thing right now for the U.S., for the international community at large, is to raise their voices very loudly about this situation. The Egyptian authorities have gotten very skilled at spinning everything into a narrative of security, and really this started under the language of counterterrorism. And I think that so long as the U.S., so long as other countries in the international community at large turns a blind eye because they don't want to jeopardize security ties or they don't want to be seen as soft on terror, then you're going to see this crackdown continue. So the more that the U.S. and the international community can raise their voices very loudly, then the more I think we'll potentially see an impact here.
That's Justin Shalad, Senior Middle East and North Africa Researcher for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Justin, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.